The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting from 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, California time listeners. Welcome to this special edition at this special time for our Monday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in to what I promise will be an extremely important and very interesting and informative program. A couple of quick announcements. If you would like to call us and talk to our guest, who I will introduce in just a minute, excuse me, the phone number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners, so be patient. The line will be answered, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also reach us via email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, and then through our blog on our website, thespaceshow.com. So remember to do this all the way over to the right, upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed. Open that page up. That is our archive page for this program. And then down at the bottom, you can comment or send in questions, which we will get almost instantly. You do not have to log in to anything to post a comment or question. You can do so as a guest. So those are the three ways that you can participate in our show today. Our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace at thespaceshow.com and the Space Show blog. So also at thespaceshow.com, we have a detailed newsletter, and that was uploaded fresh yesterday evening. So you will see all of the programs planned for the week in detail and our upcoming show schedule going into early August of this year. Remember that everything we do is archived, and you can download shows very quickly, or you can also listen right off of our website. Don't forget the Space Show store in the upper left menu. This is for people who would like Space Show t-shirts, coffee mugs, things of that nature. This is where you get our logo wear, so please do check it out. The most important button is center right, and that is to support the Space Show. Remember, we're a nonprofit, 501c3 with one O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. We can bring you these programs because many of you do financially contribute to our program. Remember, as a 501c3 nonprofit, if you're a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true if you are a California taxpayer, as we are a California public benefit corporation. Remember that we're trademarked and copyrighted, and all of you do have permission to download our programs and distribute them. You can do so by sending the file out, or you can just send out the URL. There are a couple of rules about it. One, don't do anything commercial with our programs. Number two, don't edit or take clips and put them up on YouTube or any other website, including your own. And there are no written transcripts permitted, and that's true even if they're for your own use. So please do read our copyright statement at the bottom of every one of our website pages, as well as our parent nonprofit website, onegiantleapfoundation.org. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask me. And you can find how we're podcasting on our website, on the newsletters, and we are in iTunes, and you shouldn't really have any problem. If you have any smartphone issues with our podcast, don't hesitate to email me, again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Check out from time to time the banner ads going across our website for our sponsors. We would not be doing these programs without our terrific sponsors. And there are two of them for the first segment of today's program. As you all know, the Integrated Space Plan is a sponsor. This is a detailed 100-year forecast for our future in space. It includes Earth to orbit, reusable in-space transportation, and more. It also depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. It's all available for you at thespaceplan.com. And if you click on the online version, there are 500 elements or cells, and they all expand for more information. You can also buy a huge poster of the Integrated Space Plan. This, too, is available at their website, thespaceplan.com. And then the Space Symposium by the Space Foundation is a sponsor, and that's just around the corner, everybody, April 3rd through the 6th. Their website is spacesymposium.org, and it is considered the 2017 must-attend space industry event. It is the 33rd symposium. Remember, my panel with the NASA Center Directors is Wednesday morning, and if you are going to be there, make sure you find me. I look forward to meeting you. And that brings me to welcoming back to the show, after a very long absence, way too long of an absence, Dr. Coyote Smith, who's a retired Air Force colonel. And Dr. Smith is now a professor of strategic studies at the Air University's E-School of Graduate Professional Military Education. He retired from active duty in August of last year while serving as a professor of strategic space studies at the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies. Prior to this, he served as the director of the Center for Strategy and Technology, where he led Project Blue Horizons for the Air Force Chief of Staff. And earlier, he served at the Pentagon as the Chief of DreamWorks, which was the Future Concepts Division of the National Security Space Office. And there, he led the Defense Sciences Board and directed their famous space-based solar power study. Coyote's full bio is up on our website. I urge you to check it out and read all about his incredible service to the United States, to our country, and his accomplishments. But as always, it's a lot more fun and more interesting to talk to our guest, Coyote in particular, than to read about him. So welcome back to the Space Show. It has been way too long, and it's great to have you back on the program.
Yeah, thanks, David. Thanks for having me back. And you're right, it has been so long.
And you have come up with a topic that we have discussed over the years on the Space Show that probably the vast majority of Space Show listeners really gravitate toward and would like to see it happen. Your paper is titled America Needs a U.S. Space Corps. So tell us about this idea.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm sitting here at my desk minding my own business, not bothering anybody, and I get a telephone call from the office of our commanding general, Lieutenant General Steve Quast. And he tells me that our Congressman Mike Rogers from Alabama District 3, who's also the chairman of one of the strategic oversight committees on the House Armed Services Committee, is making noise about possibly how to reorganize for national security space better than what the Air Force is currently able to do. And if you're familiar with Congressman Rogers' inputs that have gone into the media over the last few months, he's very concerned about the lack of priority that space has inside of the Air Force. And it's not. And I would like to step right up front and say this. The Air Force has been a very responsible servant of the orders that it's given by Congress. But as it's written now, the primary mission of the United States Air Force is air power. And every other mission will be compromised or sacrificed to provide for that primary mission. That is their marching orders. And so Congressman Rogers is actually very concerned about the increasing foreign activity in outer space, the clear and unambiguous rise of certain kinds of space threats that they see with their intelligence insights, and wants to ensure that something is created, some entity that will place space as its top priority. This is an interesting prospect when you stop and think about it. We've always said, everybody I think has always said and had an assumption that someday we would have an independent space force. We all thought that there would be some evolutionary path towards that independence. Well, after 60 years of space in the Air Force, we haven't even taken a single step in that direction. And in fact, to some degree, we've actually taken steps backwards. You'll probably remember the Rumsfeld Space Commission.
Right.
Yeah. When that came out in 2001, it was heralded as the last attempt to try to get space right inside the Air Force before Congress would act to create something separate, a separate service, a separate government agency, a separate department, something separate for space. And there was a great deal of excitement. There was about 9 to 14 recommendations that came out of the Rumsfeld Space Commission, and the Air Force started down the path of implementing them. But then it happened, 9/11. And in the months that followed, the Air Force rescinded or retracted on the implementation of those ideas, those recommendations. And, of course, you know, it got even worse because with the need to stand up U.S. NORTHCOM, finally having a unified combatant command to defend North America, something which we had not had at that point, if you can believe that or not, they decided to stand down U.S. Space Command, which, if you're familiar with the way the military, the United States military, organized, trains, and equips, U.S. Space Command was the joint organization that oversaw all space operations for the United States. When we got rid of that unified combatant command, we basically lost a seat at what they call the Joint Requirements Oversight Council or Committee. I can't remember which, the JROC. And the JROC is the organization that sets the joint priorities and requirements for their operational theaters that the services turn around and have to provide capabilities to fill the gaps that are identified. We did assign space to U.S. Strategic Command, which also deals with nuclear and cyber operations as well. And so in addition to space being minimized inside the Air Force as being a secondary or tertiary mission, it also became one of three competing missions inside its U.S. Strategic Command, which hosts it as the joint service organization. As we advance the clock forward, you remember the Allard Commission that came out in the mid-1990s, kind of as a follow-on to the Rumsfeld Commission. Recommendations were made, and nothing was done. And here's what's happening. This is what always seems to happen. We always seem to have some momentum to advance our American space power, and then some conflict, or some crisis, or some contingency, or some cost overrun happens in some primary mission air power program that the Air Force must close on, and either the priority for space gets put on the back burner again, or for all due reasonable purposes, the Air Force simply must take some of the space budget to complete its primary mission. And so these are the concerns that Congressman Mike Rogers has voiced in the media. And he is looking for proposals and recommendations and solutions that can help nudge the art of American spacefaring further than what the Air Force can reasonably be expected to do.
Are you looking for something that has U.S. authority, or is this going to patrol space kind of like the Coast Guard does and have international authority and protective capabilities?
Well, you know, this is a very important question, David, because ultimately we do think that the America's best interests in space will be represented by an independent service. The idea that I put forward of having a U.S. Space Corps under the Secretary of the Air Force, like the Marine Corps is to the Navy, with an independent commandant and not, for the first time ever, not responsible to the air power masters underneath the chief of staff of the Air Force, will give us an opportunity to create a cadre of career-focused space professionals not distracted by air power or the other various missions, but so that they can really focus on becoming the center of excellence for national security space. But as you have pointed out many times in your shows, space is not necessarily a warfighting medium. Space is a global asset. And Air Force Space Command, in concert with our National Reconnaissance Office and with our civil providers, but mostly, and this is the right way things should be, our commercial space sector, provide capabilities globally to, well, the entire population of the globe. It's really quite a massive type of operation when you think about it. We have roughly 1,500 satellites of all national registries on orbit provide such incredible capabilities that have transformed fundamentally the way of life on this planet for just about everyone. And we are improving quality of life wherever space capabilities penetrate. And we don't want to have that interrupted for any reason whatsoever, to include the occasion of warfare on the planet. The perspective of a space professional is very different than an airman. Our flying airmen train for war, and they go to war. And when they're not at war, they're training for war. But our space professionals are entirely different. We have to provide services 24/7, 365 days a year, perpetually, everywhere on the globe. We have to provide those services largely to the civilian, peaceful population. And when there is a war, we are fortunate that war typically occurs only in a small, tiny little region inside a theater on the surface of the globe, or at sea, or in the air. But it's a relatively small and isolated place. But our space systems have to provide service continuously around the globe, whether our airmen feel they are at war or not. It's a 24/7, 365-day space proposition. And this is a fundamental difference. And because of this, we do see that this interim step to full independence, and by that I mean the establishment of U.S. Space Corps under the Secretary of the Air Force as an interim step, this gives us the opportunity to assemble the space professionals in the security community, but also we will need to look at our commerce and our constabulary, meaning law enforcement responsibilities, so that we can ensure protection of life, protection of property, freedom of passage, freedom of navigation for all peaceful and lawful users of outer space, regardless of nationality. And you are very right, David, that that is very much a Coast Guard-like and a very internationalized type of role and mission. It is something that lends itself to international cooperation, while at the same time respecting the necessary requirement for economic competition and respect for intellectual property and appreciation for establishing new firsts that advance human spacefaring.
You have an email question already about this, and this is James, who's in Seattle. And he says, Coyote, the U.S. Navy, I guess along with the Coast Guard, maintains freedom of passage for the United States and probably for the world. But they do that with very sophisticated military weapons on board ships, including the best air power that rivals the Air Force air power. They have guns. They have missiles. They do this in a way that says, don't mess with us, and we are benevolent, and we want free passage for everybody. But this is backed up with an extremely big and powerful stick. So now you want to do this for space. And right now there doesn't seem to be any nations that want to stop the unrestricted use of space for other countries or commercial companies, but that could happen down the road. So how do you back it up? Are you anticipating that there's going to be a big stick and weapons platform like the U.S. Navy and Coast Guard, or is this going to be obey us because we're the U.S. Space Corps?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and thank you, James, out there in Seattle. That's a great question, and that's one that we talk about a great deal. Just because we have those guns on those ships doesn't instantly propel us towards war.
No, but it backs up the force of what you're trying to do.
Yes, it does. And we have to take into account that over time there will evolve hostile and non-lawful users of outer space. In the case of those folks that will behave in a hostile manner, there must be some martial means of reprise to deter attacks, to defend our assets from attack, and also to use space to promote the projection of American power in order to resolve conflicts at the earliest possible times on terms favorable to the United States, its allies, and what we would typically refer to as the international world order. We want to preserve the free flow of commerce, etc. The next thing is that there will be people that will behave illegally in outer space. There will be satellites that will abscond with signals from other satellites. There will be, as there are already, droves of cyber type of attacks against satellites or electronic attacks of various kinds, directed energy attacks, etc. And some means of remediation, of mitigation, needs to be put into place. Now, that does not mean that you put weapons in space that are going to have an impact on the surface of the Earth. The bottom line is, air power is pennies on the dollar compared to putting a weapon in space for the purpose of striking anything on the surface of the Earth. What we would see on orbit would probably be electronic jamming systems. You know, the greatest jammer of a communication satellite is another communication satellite. It's not like you will see James Bond classes of weapons put into outer space that are beyond your imagination and that are mega violent, and that some sinister guy rubbing his hands petting a white Persian cat will be employing to trick everybody on the planet into bending to their will. I think we will probably see in the near term reclassification of most satellites for their dual purpose use. Any satellite on orbit can be used as a weapon. If it emits a signal, that signal can be focused at another satellite to jam those signals. It's just a statement of fact. If you have a satellite and you can maneuver it, you could maneuver it to ram into another satellite. That's also a statement of fact. But you know what? Nobody is talking about kinetic attack satellites. Nobody is talking about anything that creates space debris. Nobody. We hear all this talk about these anti-satellite weapons and these missiles that will go into space and blow up these satellites. You know, why would you spend tens of millions of dollars on such a vehicle that is designed to create massive fields of space debris that will eventually ruin your own satellites? That's not the point. Those types of systems largely, in my humble opinion, are missile defense tests that other nations are cleverly hiding as anti-satellite tests. They know the United States is far more dependent on space, and they're trying to engender an overreaction on behalf of the United States to have us sink our time and treasure into, goose chases, by and large.
So you think the enforcement would come? So how would enforcement come on a bad actor if we had a U.S. Space Corps?
Well, it comes in a couple of different ways. First of all, a U.S. Space Corps would be able to assemble its own priorities for accomplishing missions in space. This is an interesting thing. Lieutenant General Stephen Quast is the commander of Air University, president of Air University at this time. And he has been involved with a study over the past, going on a year now, called Ultra-Low-Cost Access to Space, basically taking a look at how the U.S. government, and that's across the civil and security sectors, could benefit over time by leveraging the reduction in launch costs being brought on by reusabilities that companies such as SpaceX and Blue Origin, et cetera, are bringing about. And one of the things that he discovered is even if we could massively reduce space launch costs, the Air Force probably still would not buy any of those types of systems because a single-use type of system is just too much for the Air Force, and it just doesn't rise to the priority to compete well against the Air Force's air power missions. However, if you had an independent an autonomous space corps underneath the Secretary of the Air Force, lowering the cost of access to space would be one of the primary missions that would be pursued. And so here you see how the bureaucracy of simply nesting space inside the Air Force, an organization has different priorities, prevents us from advancing American spacefaring prowess. I think everybody, every taxpayer, would like to have a significant reduction in launch costs for the government, but we don't really have the organization that, that drives the propellant forward for that type of change, whereas a U.S. Space Corps could start us down that road towards that goal. One of the things that goes back to answer part of Jim's question from Seattle is as we take a look at the establishment of a Space Corps as an interim step, is the assembling the Space Corps would involve bringing together the national security, the complete enterprise of national security. And once we have done that, and we don't need to do it quickly, there's a big problem. If we created a separate space force, or if we created a separate space guard, with the nuances that both of those terms mean, we would probably make a mistake. But if by moving prudently to make a autonomous space corps first, we could stop and take a look, massage the international relations that are going to be necessary, deal favorably with our allies, to assess whether we want it to become, whether that next increment to full independence should be in the form of a U.S. Space Force under the Department of Defense, or maybe a U.S. Space Guard underneath Homeland Security and the other departments as the U.S. Coast Guard is. I think that's an important distinction that I'd like to make. We're not talking about doing anything quick or fast. We're talking about prudently assembling a Space Corps and then giving it time to see what the right direction is likely to be. Meanwhile, we will have established the budget mechanisms, the programming mechanisms, and the organizational mechanisms that will allow us to succeed with whatever the next follow-on step would be to independence.
You have a caller who's been waiting, so I'm going to bring your caller up and let you talk to this person. Hi, caller. Welcome to our show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Richard Easton from Dallas.
Go ahead, Richard.
First question, I wonder how Russia and China structure it. Do they have independent space corps?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I can't say that I'm a Russian or a Chinese expert. I can say that we look at Russia and China, and they are able to move remarkably faster at generating ideas and fielding whole system capabilities than we are right now. That may be because they have discovered some fancy way to streamline their bureaucracy and acquisition paths, or that might be because they have given greater autonomy to their space service, I guess, their space department, branch, whatever. But they're able to move faster than we are. And that's one of the primary concerns. Recently, a paper written an author attributed to Senator John McCain, who, of course, chairs the Senate Armed Services Committee, pointed out that America's dependency on space grows, but the threats posed by adversary nations out there seem to grow faster. This, in part, speaks to a bureaucracy problem that we have here that, for some reason, our adversaries don't seem to have. It may be because they have independence. I'm not sure.
I know you go back 25 years, but my dad started working on space in 52, so I have some memory. And Lee Hammerstrom said in 1967, the chief of naval operations was visiting the Naval Research Lab. And Lee was working there, as was my dad. And they made sure that they told the CNO that the current structure, which McNamara had made the Air Force the lead sometime in the early 60s, was not working for the Navy, and that changes were needed. And so we're talking about 50 years ago. And for the early development of the of GPS, which, as David knows, I've written a book about, Cargo Hall, I think, said that the Air Force really didn't understand what they had.
Yeah.
And if they pushed it harder, you know, the civilian applications would have come sooner. I know last July, my co-author and I spoke at Air Force Space Command, and I know one of General Hyten's concerns was that we address the significant civilian component of GPS, because he wanted his people there to be aware that, you know, it's a significant dual use, and things like timing are less obvious, but nonetheless critical to our infrastructure. So, your idea sounds good. Because we do seem to be atrophying.
Yeah, we sure do. And in fact, you're right about the Air Force. The Air Force did not really understand the tremendous asset that GPS is. Back in between 96 and 99, I was assigned to the Air Force Weapons School. I'm what they call a space weapons officer. And I specialized in teaching GPS and the employment of GPS munitions. And JDAM had not come on yet. In fact, that was one of the programs that I was working on at the time. And the Air Force did not have any real GPS-guided systems that it was committed to. It simply would not make a commitment to having anything from space used to improve guidance of its munitions, if you can believe that now, now that we know the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say. But in 1996 and 97, the Air Force actually had a commission led by one of our generals, a retired general, and they were looking at deactivating GPS because in their mind nobody was using it.
I know that was the case in the early 80s, and what you said happened with space, I think was happening with GPS back then. The Air Force would zero it out, knowing Congress would put money back in, so they'd have more money for air. 96, 97? Boy, that's...
Yeah, I mean,
that
was that
incredible
late.
To hear. You know, by then... well, you start the first applications really of GPS, and of course, one big myth is that GPS started as a military-only system. That's not true.
Right.
The 74 GPS development plan talks about the CA signal
exactly, you
know, in the clear. And when I was interviewing Harry Sunderman, who was with NABSEC before the JPO, so that we're talking about the late 60s, he said, people like the DOT were in the Department of Transportation, they were all interested in, well, didn't have GPS name until late 73, Defense Navigation Satellite System to be the successor to Transit. They were all interested in it, but nobody was interested in funding it but the DOD. So, you know, from the very beginning, GPS was a dual-use system. And starting in 82, so this is a year before a Korean airliner was shot down, you know, surveyors started using GPS because with the Block 1 test satellites, you might have four or five up there. Eventually, I think they got 10. But, you know, you could just put up your surveying equipment and wait for the satellites to come over. So so even in the mid-80s, it was being used. And, boy, you're talking about 95, 96. By that point, we were probably already getting more than $1 billion economic. I mean, today it's $100 billion a year for the U.S. But even back then, it was very significant. So I'm surprised that they were not aware of that.
Well, it's difficult because they did not have a good they didn't have a really well established customer GPS user interface, if you would. We didn't have the ability to monitor things on the internet to find out who was doing what as we do now. And I'm just glad that we preserved that capability. And you know, the risk of having given up on that really makes me nervous, because I wonder what other type of just transformative, wonderful capabilities over the years we've given up on.
Coyote, to what degree would the U.S. Space Corps be totally dependent, partially dependent? To what degree would it be dependent upon enforcement and capability from GPS?
You know, that's a great question, David. You know, one of the things that sound prudent military planning would provide is that, yes, of course, we would use GPS and we would continue to provide GPS free to all users everywhere. And we like that. But sound prudence means that we need to have receivers that can also benefit from using the European GPS Galileo constellation, and, you know, it's Chinese Beidou, the Russian GLONASS, etc. Space-based navigation really should not be predicated on any single nation's satellites and concerns. You know, and a guest that you've had on, Scott Pace, of course,
uh-huh.
was one of the instrumental negotiators with the European Union trying to bring about accommodation with GPS and GLONASS in terms of GPS and Galileo, excuse me, in trying to bring about an accommodation for commonized signals and pseudorandom noise patterns that never flowed, that never carried through. You know, to some degree, having the wide diversity between Galileo and GPS will be a strength, because you would have to take down each of the satellites in both of those constellations and engender a much broader war if you wanted to take down precision navigation and timing around the planet. If you are able to use your adversary's satellites, such as, you know, we anticipate that they would try to use ours while we try to preserve our signal, that also gives you a great deal more robustness.
That was one of the points I made in Colorado Springs during the Q&A period, that yes, I understand Congress has forbidden the military to use either the Chinese or the Russian systems unless there's a specific waiver, but it's only adding to your capabilities. I mean, any military receiver, you know, they're going to, by definition, they're going to use GPS, and then they might have order of priority. But given how slow military procurement is, you need to be starting it yesterday.
Yes.
I mean, so you use four systems. Again, you all start with GPS, so there's no way in which it makes us more vulnerable. But again, bureaucracy doesn't like to change things.
That's correct. And one of the benefits of having a U.S. Space Corps as an autonomous entity is that we would grow a cadre of several thousand space professionals. I would call them space corpsmen in my papers. Space corpsmen that would spend their entire career, instead of going away to Air Force colleges, and I teach at Air University, but if a student today comes to Air Command and Staff College for the year-long in-residence master's program, or if they come back to the Air War College for another year-long master's program, in each one of those courses, they will only receive 120 minutes of discussion about American space power. If you can believe it, it's incredible. It is not enough to advance the mastery of the outer space environment that needs to take place. Instead of teaching space power to our current space professionals, they sit through all the air power courses. They understand everything about air power and the employment of air power, but they understand nothing about space power. Excuse me, I don't want to say nothing about it. They simply haven't benefited from the enrichment of the education that could be provided to them to make good on the promise of American space power, to advance it further, to improve its overall ability to ensure free navigation, freedom of property, freedom and protection of life in space, and to think, well, think boldly. There's that word that we like to use in the space community.
Richard, anything else on your side, or we're going to move on?
One other comment. Sequestration resulted in the destruction in 2013 of one of my dad's systems, the Naval Space Surveillance System, which was transferred to the Air Force in the early 2000s. So we don't know. Brian Whedon trying to figure out how much it was actually costing. We're maybe $15 million a year, and now they do have successors. But again, you know, with sequestration, the Air Force faced very difficult decisions. Congress didn't allow it to look at things intelligently. You know, they had to cut each budget by 7% or whatever the number was. So if you had a separate space component, you know, if Congress did something stupid like that again, they would be probably able to more do a more reasonable cut.
Yes.
Because they're focused on those assets.
That's very right, Richard, and I'm glad that you point that out. And I also like the tone and attitude that you take with that, because our airmen and our Air Force are making the same decisions that any one of us would if we were them. They have their priorities established for them by Congress, and they have been loyal and faithful to that, and they've done a good service. But space, if it's assigned to any other organization as a secondary mission, it will always receive short shrift. And we also must not overlook something that I said before, but I want to give it emphasis. You know, every year we submit a budget, and the space budget is always, you know, programmed out nice and healthy-like and to make things happen. We might not get our priorities, but at least we've got money to make a reasonable showing in our program set. But then the unexpected happens. There is always some crisis or some contingency or some cost overrun in some aircraft program that the Air Force has no choice. They've got to find funds or resources from inside their own service, and so those secondary missions, space and cyber, will take the hit. It's very responsible for them to do that.
And yet, long term, you know, cyber gets knocked out.
Right.
Everything gets knocked out. I mean, it's like saying, well, you have hardening of your Air Force bases, but if they depend on the civilian power, you know, the power grid goes down, good luck.
Yeah.
So cyber is an absolutely critical component, and yet it's like, what was the solar storm from 1959?
1859.
Carrington, what?
Carrington, yeah.
Carrington. Doesn't happen very often, but when it does happen, you're going to miss the fact that your power grid's not hardened.
Yeah.
It'll be a catastrophe. And GPS is so woven into our structure that if you suddenly lost half the constellation, you know, the effects would be significant. And and at that point, people will start screaming bloody murder. Why didn't we, in our military equipment, why didn't we have Galileo, GLONASS, and BeiDou as backups? You know, you can imagine congressional committees screaming where they'd forbidden the Air Force to do that unless there was a specific waiver, but of course Congress always forgets that.
Yeah,
something bad happens.
And there is a cultural point there where the Air Force has to take criticism, and that is that they have not trained their cadre of space professionals, educated their cadre of space professionals to be more futuristically thinking. To be thinking more futuristically, to be thinking ahead, to be leaning forward with a space-centered concept of operations, and instead we have taught our space professionals air power and air-mindedness. You know, if the Air Force has 31 volumes of air power doctrine, that each one describing in a great detail the finest points, the greatest, least details of any one of their missions that they perform, but they've only given our space community one single 79-page book of doctrine that we use to educate our people, and it does little more than explain the organizational structures and how space capabilities are provided and fed to airmen in the forward theater.
Guys, I got to move us on and take our break. So
thank you much. Great
thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Richard. By the way, I always kind of chuckle when people expect Congress to do something that is wise and proper and all of that, because they don't do that. And why should anyone living today expect that from whatever Congress has evolved to today? You know, what part of our government do they do that with? So I think your idea and things that Richard say and other people say, you come out of the starting box with some albatrosses around your neck, dependent upon Congress, because they don't have a track record of doing the wise, forward-thinking kind of thing that we all wish that they did. And I know that's a cynical view, Coyote, but I also think it's a realistic view, and I'd love to see that turned around. I have no idea how you turn that around.
Well, I think that is. I kind of have a sense of empathy for the members of Congress because they themselves are stuck into...
Well, they do it themselves.
Yeah, they do.
And their rules and their systems and their parties, which are, I think, antiquated in many ways, and their ideology. But they're victims of their own way of doing things. But it hurts everybody, and it certainly does hurt what you're talking about, which is, I think, very, very important. We are going to take our break. We're at the halfway point. I'd like to find out how we make this happen when you come back.
Great. I've got some ideas.
Yeah. So let's talk about how to bring it to life. So, listeners, we're going to be back with Coyote and more on a U.S. Space Corps. And would it help if we made it an international Space Corps? We can ask our guest that in about 3 minutes, so don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody, part two of our special Monday morning Space Show program. We do have a caller holding for Coyote, but I got a couple of sponsors to tell you about. And Coyote, picture this. One of our sponsors is Celestis, which is the greatest company for Memorial spaceflight ever since 1995. And they have this new service where you can put your DNA into space. So if your loved one, who you want to honor by sending to space, wants a traditional burial, you can send their DNA to space, but you can also send your own DNA to space as well. This is all done in partnership with CG Labs of Canada. And you can also store DNA, and you can get all the information you need at Celestis.com. But just imagine an orbiting satellite with DNA and cremated remains on board that the U.S. Space Corps has to protect somehow. So that'd be a novel use of the U.S. Space Corps, right? AIAA is a sponsor, and that's the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And they have more than 30,000 individual members from 88 countries and 95 corporate members. They do help shape the future of aerospace every day. They advance the state of aerospace science, technology, and engineering, and they increase our knowledge of the universe, and they bring the world closer together. They're an incredible organization. Going back many, many years, they were instrumental in helping me write my doctoral dissertation on commercial space. Visit them at AIAA.org. Go to their events. You'll meet most of the people that come on the Space Show. really a great organization. The same for Orbital ATK, which is a sponsor. They're a global leader in aerospace and defense technologies and the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems, for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And I can just hear the call to the U.S. Space Corp, protect my husband's remains on orbit. But we have Dallas Binoff with us as a caller. And, Dallas, it's great to hear from you again. And you're on with Coyote Smith.
Well, thanks, David. It's good to be a caller again. It's been a long time since I've even listened because of the timing and such. But, Coyote, good to hear from you.
Yeah, good to hear from you too, Big D.
I read your article online at, I believe it was Space Ref. And very, very interesting. So I'm wondering if you can enlighten us. You know, the Air Force has bombers and fighters and cargo planes and a few other things. The Navy has carriers, destroyers, frigates, littoral combat ships. What kind of a fleet would the Space Corps have?
Oh, well, gee, I'm glad that you asked. One of the things that is important to any long-term space program and to secure interests in outer space has to do with long-duration missions. It also has to deal with providing, let me start right there and I'll just describe for you what I think the vision for a Space Corps will become. First of all, just like the Coast Guard manages a series of tugs, etc., along with the merchant marine and other types of commercial equities, I imagine that we will have tugs so that when satellites using cheaper rockets, because they won't have to go all the way out to GEO, they will just launch to LEO some of their payloads, and then one of these tug sats will pick up the payload and will carry it to its orbit, whether it's in deep LEO or MEO or maybe even a geostationary orbit, and establish it. Now, of course, that tug sat can be reused many, many times. It'll need to have refueling depots on orbit where it gets refueled. And because we have refueling depots, maybe that same tug sat can also be a refueling and servicing satellite in addition to just being a tug. That means that it could go and refuel satellites on orbit if they experience station-keeping problems because they have expended too much of their fuel, or suppose they have a mission that requires them to maneuver frequently. Yeah, we're all familiar with reconnaissance satellites that are going to orbit now that just free-float and take images beneath them. But adversaries can anticipate and predict when those satellites are going to go overhead, and as a result, they can duck and cover and hide and conceal whatever type of low-down, no-good, nefarious, bad-guy stuff that they're up to. So if we have maneuvering type of reconnaissance satellites that could sneak up and surprise an adversary, we would be able to capture a better semblance of the ground truth, which should be able to improve our overall diplomatic performance and allow our politicians to engage with a greater semblance of the truth before we have to get engaged with our armed forces. So I do see fuel depots on orbit. I see space tugs, refuelers, and maintenance vehicles. I can also imagine that with the assurance of a space guard, that as space tourists go into space, we will probably need vessels on orbit, manned or unmanned, maybe a combination of each, which can serve as emergency escape or emergency rescue systems. Suppose a space habitat has some type of critical failure, maybe a vehicle transiting between Earth and Moon for some reason stalls or fails. The ability to provide personnel recovery or human rescue will certainly be high on a Space Corps function.
Does this extend beyond LEO, or are we talking about a Space Corps only within LEO? Actually, that's a good question. Are you talking beyond LEO for the Space Corps as well, or just within LEO?
Of course, it will evolve over time, but I envision it will encompass the entire Earth-Moon system.
Yeah,
it'll be cislunar. I do believe that we will see space-based solar power satellites not only around the Earth, but we will also see them around the Moon. I believe that we will establish the same type of tug sat systems around the and fueling depots from the moon in the moon orbit, as we will see in the Earth orbit as well. I also think we will have transit vehicles in cycler orbits that will go from Earth space stations to lunar space stations, and it will be from those stations, much like the von Braun vision, where tourists and scientists and workers and miners will do the final transit down to the surface of the planet or the moon, depending on what direction they're traveling.
Now, Cody, I think what you're saying works well for a few destinations and orbits. You know, eastern out of a launch site up to GEO, any orbit out to L1, L1 to any point on the surface. But if you start talking about things like GPS or observation satellites that would be in a sun sync orbit, it becomes a lot harder to do it with a system because there are so many different orbits,
yes,
an infinite number of orbits in each plane, in each inclination.
Right.
And so, you know, how many fleets would one have to do a good job?
Well, if we had the opportunity of refueling on orbit, we could maneuver them without worrying about, you know, right now, Delta V is so precious that we just have this idea that we're locked in this unmoving orbital mechanics. But with the tug sats, with the refueling capability, with fuel regularly launching from Earth and going to replenish those gas stations in space, if you will, we will be able to expand the maneuverability. We may be able to free ourselves from the fixed, you know, having our feet stuck in the cement of orbitology. And we'll actually have dynamic space travel as opposed to being caught in the outrageously fast and the outrageously planar type of movement that we get now.
Now, Colonel Gerritsen has, I think he's used the phrase, relocation without regret.
Yeah.
Something like that.
That is great. Lips and myself, we have these conversations all the time.
Right.
The Enterprise doesn't pay attention to orbits.
No, it doesn't, David. Right.
they have something better than fusion.
Well, it would help, but that isn't where you start out, Coyote. So
right.
My understanding is you sort of crawl before you walk,
yes,
before you run. Is that kind of incremental stepping stone program?
That's absolutely right. And what I would ask, and I have three requests of Congress. Well, excuse me, rented lips. I have three requests. Congress and three requests of the president. And what I think is going to be needed is something like the National Defense Reorganization Act of 1947, which was used to create not only the independent Air Force, but also to establish, to essentially weaken all of the services and make them subordinate to a single Department of Defense, which is very interesting because at the time of World War II, we had the War Department and we had the Navy. And the two of them didn't talk that much. And there wasn't a whole lot of coordination that went on. We had air power, which had just gained its autonomy inside the Army. Get a load of this. In July of 1941. It was not the Army Air Corps that fought World War II. It was the Army Air Force that fought World War II. And so I think what we need is a National Defense Reorganization Act of, let's say, 2018. Therein, I would like them to establish a U.S. Space Corps to the Air Force, the same way the U.S. Marine Corps is to the Navy. And in so doing, I would like them to designate Air Force Space Command as the U.S. Space Corps, with the commander of Air Force Space Command being redesignated as the commandant of the Space Corps. I believe that four-star general should move to, if he's called a general, he might be called an admiral, should be moved to the Pentagon to work underneath the Secretary of the Air Force directly. This move frees the space professionals, now space corpsmen, from their air power chains. It gives them the culture, the opportunity to develop a culture that is entirely dependent on advancing American space power while providing support to the sister services. Now, that commandant of the U.S. Space Corps, like the commandant of the Marine Corps, will attend and sit in on the Joint Chiefs of Staff as a voting member when it comes to a space-related issue.
And anymore, these days, everything is a space-related issue. Now, in addition to that, I am curious about what should happen to the National Reconnaissance Office, which has its own culture, its own set of customers, its own way of doing business. And what I think should happen initially is that the National Reconnaissance Office, the director should be recognized as a three-star equivalent, and that the NRO's culture needs to be respected right up front. There's some things that they do better than the Air Force. And the Air Force needs to, you know, the current Air Force unit needs to learn from them. We need to follow their lead in many different types of programs. I think also moving them over underneath the Commandant of the Space Corps will be a relatively easy process. We did this to some degree when Mr. Peter B. Teets, was named the Undersecretary of the Air Force and also simultaneously as the Director of the NRO. It had a great deal of success in some ways, but not in others. Eventually, the concept failed, but it was in the post-9/11 environment when everybody was just finding it much easier to go back to the old way of doing business while faced with a new set of threats that we were dealing with. So in bringing the NRO over, and in bringing over whatever other elements are scattered across government to the Space Corps, we should be able to establish improved ways of doing business. Now, I'd like you to think about the Navy in this way again. Especially during World War II, you had an Atlantic Fleet and a Pacific Fleet. And the two of those fleets had very distinct cultures. They did things differently. Well, in recent years, the Navy has developed ways of assessing each one of those different ways and adopting across the Navy, across both fleets, the better way of doing business. But the Navy still engenders each one of those fleets stepping out and doing something with a sense of risk to try doing something in a better organizational, less bureaucratic, faster manner. And I think by uniting the National Reconnaissance Office and Air Force Space Command and redesignating them as two separate commands underneath the Commandant of the Space Corps, that we will have the opportunity for those organizations to leverage off that same opportunity to do things differently and for both of them to capitalize on adopting the best way of doing business when they identify it. Now, along with that, along with the simple establishment of the Space Corps, I ask for a complete fencing of all national security space-related dollars, whether they exist in the Department of Defense, in the intelligence community, or elsewhere. And this would be under Major Force Program number 12, which was set aside for space, but it has proven to be far more virtual than it has been hard. Not all of the space programmatic dollars, not all of the space manpower, personnel, and organizational dollars are captured by it, whereas it should be. This gives Congress far better oversight and gives them the assurance that the priorities of space are being funded and met, which is principally the concerns that we're hearing coming from the House Armed Services Committee, where the budget and finance begins, and also where all the complaints are aired when changes to the space budget or programmatics occur. There is no need, I don't see a need for a wild spending in order to create this Space Corps. Just as the Marine Corps continues to leverage off Navy bases, Navy facilities, Navy schools, etc., with due independence for them to do their unique form of training and education, I think we will be able to continue to reside on Air Force bases or installations, except for the places where there are no aircraft, there's no air-related mission. And there's many of those types of bases in Air Force Space Command right now. Those would duly be designated as space bases. And then the third thing that I ask Congress to do is to establish a geographic unified combatant commander for space. This is bringing back U.S. Space Command. This gives them a seat at the JROC, the Joint Requirements Oversight Council or Committee. I can't remember which one that is, the JROC. This gives them the opportunity that this would be a four-star general from the Joint Forces who commands U.S. Space Command as a geographic rather than functional commander. The old U.S. Space Command was a functional, which meant that it was just a service provider, a force provider to the other commanders out there. It did not execute anything under its own name. But as a geographic combatant commander, That would be dramatically different. A geographic combatant commander would have the opportunity to direct air forces or sea forces in other theaters, or even land forces, to engage threats against space systems. For example, let's say that in let's pick some area where we have an open contest today. Let's say, such as in Syria. If we detect satellite jammers nailing our critical communications on orbit or assaulting our commercial customer base satellites in the commercial sector, the commander of U.S. Space Command should be able to direct air forces to go in and strike, or land forces, etc. Of course, that's predicated on approval of the president for those types of actions, so it's not like they're stepping out on their own and behaving in a militarily irresponsible manner. That's not what we're looking for. We want proper due prudence. All actions will be done in accordance with the laws of armed conflict and also in accordance with the rules of engagement.
Now, you're really saying he should be able to identify targets and say, I want that target taken out. Go make it happen however it has to happen.
Correct. That's exactly right. And there was no mechanism for that to actually happen when it was a functional. If, for example, there was jamming coming out of Syria that was nailing a satellite that was, you know, Syria is in U.S. Central Command. But from Syria, they have the ability of jamming into the satellites that support operations in the Pacific. And so which commander is it that would request, the strike against the jammer? Would it be the commander of U.S. Pacific Command, where the effect is being experienced? Or would it be the commander of U.S. Central Command, where the actual weapon is engaging, and whose forces would have to be engaged in order to take out the threat? See, that creates ambiguity. But if the commander of Air Force, if the commander of the U.S. Space Command, where the effect is actually, where the actual jamming is occurring on a satellite, could detect and geolocate and hand off that information to terrestrial forces, we'd be able to move more swiftly through combat operations.
Hey, David.
Yes.
David, I'm going to relinquish the line for other callers.
Dallas, thank you,
Tony,
so much for calling in. It's really good hearing from you again.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Dallas.
Good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Listeners, real quickly, for anyone else who might want to call, 1-866-687-7223. So how do we make it so, bring it to life? What are your ideas for putting this program in place, which, as I said earlier on, I think all of us agree would be extremely beneficial for the country and probably for the Western world?
I've been working very intently with some of the staffers for Congressman Mike Rogers from Alabama's 3rd District, who is that chair of that all-important House Armed Services Committee Strategic Oversight. They need to make the noise. Congress needs to act on this. And I do believe that promoting and pushing through legislation for a National Defense Reorganization Act is the way to go. I think that's easily attainable. The other thing that it will require, just because of the significance and symbolism of the office, I have 3 recommendations for the president. And my 3 recommendations are as follows for the president. First of all, first, and almost foremost, I would like to see a massive declassification about what is known about space threats and the engagements that have occurred there already. Any idea that space was ever a sanctuary? Yeah, no. Nice, but no. Space has been an electromagnetic shooting gallery since I came in 30 years ago. Most all of it has been either naturally caused or inadvertent signal crossovers, but even the International Telegraphic Union, the ITU, which manages all frequencies, channels, and bandwidths on orbit and has the responsibility for deconflicting those channels, will tell you that between 7 and 9% of the jamming that is occurring on orbit is intentional. That means somebody is engaging those satellites to deny their signals to users for political purposes. The famous case in point is Iran's jamming of Eutelsat and a couple other European satellites to prevent news from the West from creeping into the Middle East. This has been ongoing. It happens regularly. And we're sitting here watching this type of stuff, but because space is out of sight, out of mind, and you don't see that it doesn't cause bloodshed, people are ignoring it.
Well, they don't know about it, Coyote,
exactly,
because it is classified.
This is why I'm calling for a declassification of these types of space threats. Obviously, I can't provide specific examples because of the classification barriers, but the American public needs to know about this kind of stuff. But there's also some propellants for people to keep the classification barriers in place. First, you've got the realists who prefer keeping space matters classified for fear of empowering their adversaries with too much information. Secondly, you've got the idealists who persist in the narrative that space is a sanctuary in the hopes that some type of international mechanism can somehow be put into place to prevent further militarization of outer space. And lastly, you've got the commercial satellite industry that doesn't like to have those types of threats disclosed, because if they can't provide assurance for signals to their customers, they can lose tremendous capital. And I suppose I could throw in the Air Force there that isn't really anxious to declassify them either, because, well, they haven't been doing anything to prevent that.
So that's an uphill challenge to get the president to release that.
Yeah, that of course will be an uphill challenge, but I think it's absolutely necessary. I'm not trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes. I want that stuff declassified so we can have a serious wake up and get some stuff done. Now, that being said, if they do declassify stuff, there's no need to overreact. We have some time. We just take everything one day at a time. We'll advance it prudently, without tipping over apple carts, not doing anything rash or emotional that's going to make other nations trigger a rash and emotional response, because we do not want that. And so we're going to have to engage diplomatically, and that's going to have to come from the direction of the president, to ensure that as we declassify things and people become aware of events, that everyone remains calm.
Several months ago, Coyote, there was an ABC TV show on security vulnerabilities with space, and a lot of Air Force personnel were interviewed and facilities were visited. You probably saw the program.
Yes, and I believe it was CNN. We actually captured that.
CNN,
with permission, we actually are using that as an educational tool then.
Okay, so, that certainly was alarming to anyone paying attention, assuming they believed it and thought it was credible, and it certainly appeared to be very credible. So if they can talk about that and the threats and the organizations and sort of the structure that's loosely in place to combat all of this, then one has to be smart enough, one would think, to think that this crap is going on. Otherwise, why would you be spending the money and creating the resources and the infrastructure and the command structure to respond?
Yeah, and I'd like to point out that that's exactly right, David, and that I'd like to point out that this is Congress that's asking for a look at a reorganization. This is not the Air Force asking for it or Space Command. This is downward directed by our political masters, the folks that actually sit there and read this classified stuff in the House Armed Services Committee. They and their staffers see this happening day in and day out, and they are getting nervous and scared. Now, we as space professionals in the Air Force, and I hope we do become space corpsmen, will have the responsibility of making sure that our recommendations are sound, measured, balanced with diplomatic approaches as necessary, hopefully towards the formation of effective international norms or maybe even treaties that may help assist us in our security preparations. But we want to make sure that space is secure for all lawful and non-hostile users, regardless of nationality. That's the principal concern here. The next thing that I want the president to do, I'd like to have them discontinue publishing national space policies and the national security space strategies. Those documents are not helpful. We don't publish them for air or for land or for sea, but when we publish them for space, they're taken as, there's the final word for this administration. We'll have to wait another 8 years, and nothing gets done. Those are anti-propellants that sap our energy and prevent us from actually pressing ahead. Now, I'm not saying that our intentions, our signals, go blind to the rest of the world. The other services already have a very natural way of doing strategic communications. They publish their own journals. They publish prolifically in journals from all around the world. They have forums. They have events. And all of that takes place. We don't have those types of things with great robustness and penetration to the public as what those other services do from space, because space, well, remains relatively small. But we need to normalize the way we do our business. I know a lot of people hate that word, normalize. I just mean we need to do business the way everybody else does business. We already understand it. We've been doing it that way for years. excuse me. It just gives us a better way of pressing ahead. And lastly, David, the last thing I would ask for the president, and this is in concert, this is not, I'm not trying to tip over apple carts with this. The Outer Space Treaty has done a lot of good, and it has done a lot of harm. And let me explain. I would like the president to either reinterpret, amend, or replace the Outer Space Treaty. We've heard over the years many, many people talking about how the Outer Space Treaty promises that, you know, space is for the good of all people, that it's to be used to benefit all people, it's for peaceful purposes, for no harmful interference. All of these are good thoughts. But over time, the international community has interpreted them very differently. There are many people out there that say you cannot go to space and take the resources and bring them back and use them for commercial benefit because you're denying the use of those to everybody else. You're making a singular profit on that, whereas space is supposed to be for everybody. Basically, what has happened in the new interpretation that's evolved over time, whereas the legal intent was for space to be res communis, which is a Latin legal term that means for everyone's use, it's been interpreted that it's for everyone's use to the point that it's res nullius, which means nobody can use it. In essence, space has become a museum where you can look but don't touch. And I have to quote Scott Pace on that.
Yeah, he's coming back on the show in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. So I'm not asking for the president to tip over the apple carts, but I do think that we need to form new language that clarifies this, that specifically ensures that basic human rights are preserved in outer space. For example, why do my human rights become a bridge when I go to outer space in this sense? I should have the right to profit from the fruits of my labor. I should have the inherent right of self-defense. And I also should have the right to own private property. And as you know, those questions remain absolutely ambiguous in space because of the multiple interpretations of the Outer Space Treaty. With clarification, that will provide greater opportunity for people to secure financing and insurance. It will clarify liability and indemnity, and it will give us a much better way to press forward. Right now, I strongly suspect that space is going to become like a Nike commercial. We're going to just do it and accept whatever lawsuits are thrown at us and try to win it in court. And that's a terrible business model.
Property rights, of course, is a really hot topic with no resolution in sight. Do you advocate getting out of the Outer Space Treaty?
I do think that before we take that type of extreme measure, that we could work with like-minded nations to craft language that specifically ensure the right to own private property, the right to profit from the fruits of your labor, and the inherent right of self-defense. And those are rights that are enshrined in the Outer Space Charter and in other documents of the United Nations. But somehow that Outer Space Treaty seems to abridge those things. At least they abridge them in discussions. We graduate so many people that call themselves space lawyers every year that are dedicated to ensuring that the Outer Space Treaty is upheld. And while it ensures that very little or next to nothing gets done in space, it also leaves us trapped on this planet. We need language that ignites an economic revolution in space.
You have a caller on hold, and I've got several people emailing me that they want to get in and talk to you. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim. Go for it.
There's actually a lot of things going through my mind. I really tend to favor international approaches because of what I see as being the issue in the long-term future. And in order to try and make the point, I'd like to talk about international waters on Earth and the Somali pirate problem and how that has played out. You know, there's a lot of things that happen because we don't have an international navy on Earth that don't affect countries with power, but really affect countries that don't have power. And space is not like that, and it probably won't be like that for a long time because it's so expensive. But if you institute a core that belongs only to one country, it just seems to me like it there's a recipe there for problems. And I wonder if there would be any path for NATO to do a core like this. I don't know how the hell you would do it, but it just seems to me like, you know, a core could become so powerful, and I really wish it could be international.
Well, whatever the Space Corps would become, it would be held to standards of international law. I also imagine that at the U.S. expense, that it would be tasked to conduct a number of international missions for international users of space, much like the Navy and our Coast Guard do already, ensuring free navigability of water for all national travelers that are peaceful and non-hostile has been one of the hallmarks of maritime operations. Other nations are free to join in the establishment of space corps, and we are also free to establish venues for discussions and cooperation not only here on Earth, but also to share roles and missions in space. All users of space are entitled and should be to the free travel passage of space, the safeguarding of life and the protection of property by whoever is present.
Yeah, the model of cooperation certainly sounds really great to me. I mean, it also seems to me like intelligence would be so complementary to the kind of work you're talking about, and that having redundancy would be so important. You know, the best way to get around jamming is to have redundancy. And I think about the giant arrays of satellites that SpaceX talks about putting up and the amount of complexity that gets involved. You know, you could be talking about swarms of satellites up there at a level that we don't have experience with in a decade or so. And cooperation, I'm entirely behind that.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a nothing that we've done is considered would be considered unilateral. It's what we're trying to do is we're trying to clear up the bureaucratic lines so that we can actually advance the spacefaring for not only the United States but for the rest of the world as well.
So the model of cooperation, does that exist? Are there protocols for that?
Yeah, we already have. The United Nations has the Office of Outer Space Affairs, and we also have COPUS and the PEROS. That's the Prevention on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. Prevention of. I'm getting my acronym screwed up. we have several venues that nations come together and they discuss spacefaring topics like this. Everybody has so far been incredibly supportive of the idea, simply because not much is getting done in space. It seems that the major powers are slowing down in their own bureaucracies. So, yeah, we've got a great deal of opportunity here for international cooperation, for sure.
Yeah, that occurred to me as well, because you were talking about some projects that, of course, would be wonderful, but sound like the kind of things that NASA was meant to do. Space tugs and fuel depots. Is there potential for conflict there?
So you mean intergovernment between NASA and
Space
Corps?
Yeah, sort of that there's the interests of NASA and the interests of the Space Corps sort of work at cross purposes?
No, and you know, one of the things that's interesting about that is the Navy flies airplanes and the Army flies airplanes and the Marine Corps flies airplanes and the Air Force flies the bulk of the airplanes. So inside the Department of Defense, we're very used to and quite familiar with interoperability, with everybody having compatible or even dissimilar type of systems. So the Space Corps and having a cadre of Space Corpsmen
who specialize and spend a career studying this type of stuff would probably be in the best position to ensure that space is properly managed, that those international opportunities are capitalized on, and that multiple various users of different systems are deconflicted appropriately.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I guess that's the bulk of what I wanted to ask about. So many things seem to become possible once you have that space core. It just seems like something that sounds simple right now, but could really become something pretty transformational. So I'm glad you've clarified it so much.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Anything else, Kim?
No, I might try to leave a comment because I have ideas I just don't really know how to say. But
thank you for your call.
Thanks, Kim.
Listeners, there's still time if you want to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. What are the options for interested and supportive people? So I understand you're working through Mike Rogers and his committee. Is that the only outlet for getting attention to this, or are there other ways that people can help?
There are actually people inside, throughout government, that are interested in this idea. Certainly the Air Force is interested, the Office of the Secretary of Defense is interested, the Office of the Secretary of the Air Force. And each one of those is separate organizations, believe it or not, which kind of highlights the fact that we've got so much bureaucracy. I'm not really sure. I hadn't really thought about how John Q. Public could get involved, other than writing letters to their members of Congress. If you would like to see a space corps, I think it'd be very essential for you to send letters to your members of Congress. Now, there are so many committees and subcommittees in both the House and Senate Armed Services Committees that whoever is listening, your representatives and senators are probably sitting on those committees. And so if you would like to see us advance American space power in a sound and prudent way that gives a priority to accomplishing those types of things on orbit that are consistent with Americans' values, consistent with international treaties, laws, etc., and would like to see us moving faster in space, then I strongly encourage you to write a letter to your member of Congress or pick up a telephone, give them a call, and tell them that this is an issue that you think its time has come. You've heard me say that I think 25 years ago was the right time to establish a space corps. We should now be deciding whether or not that would look like a space force or a space guard. But we've lost 25 years of opportunity because something always happened, and the Air Force always had something better to do than space.
You know, I attend these various space conferences that focus on new space and the agenda and commercial space. I know you've attended many of them, too, and then they go to Capitol Hill and do lobbying for Mark Storm and for other things like that. But I've never seen this topic on the agendas or any new space, commercial space lobbying, except that I really think that this is a missing component for that segment, because this is what assures that you have free and unfettered commerce.
Yeah, this sure is. You know, one of the greatest job possibly that I could have ever had was DreamWorks back at the Pentagon and the National Security Space Office. We organized and coordinated the space portion of the Defense Science Board, and we would bring together NASA, the National Reconnaissance Office, the Air Force, and other government equities to talk about space. And everybody had a vision, but nobody seemed to know how to make the organizations move to bring that vision around. And it was always because if you're in the National Reconnaissance Office, you're doing space is secondary to the intelligence community. If you're in the Air Force, doing space is secondary to the Air Force. NASA does have that as a primary mission, but they deal with the civil space type of equities. And it's time for us to get the significant players, the big cash players in space, aligned and moving together to accomplish great things.
Can you say you've got another phone call on the line?
Sure.
Okay. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Marshall, and I'm still in the Dallas area.
Okay, go for it, Marshall.
Enjoy talking to you again. The key thing that I got out of the, I think it was the 1947 something or other act that made the Air Force.
Yes.
Is at the time they realized that the Air Force was going to be moving into new equipment, new areas. There was a revolution going on in aerospace technology. In space, we have kind of the same thing.
Right.
And the key thing that came out of it was the Air Force Academy, where you basically gathered the top-notch students in the country, one of which happens to be my nephew, gathered them up and trained them to work in that particular medium. And do you see a space academy, a real, you know, military space academy, being produced out of your suggestions, and where does it fit in?
Boy, you know, I sure do. In my paper, I actually wrote using the Navy's model, whereas all of the midshipmen that go to Annapolis, they declare whether or not they're going to be commissioned into the Navy or into the Marines.
Marine Corps, yeah.
And so they use that the Naval Academy, as the core for everybody's education. But they do specialize the sailors to sail and the Marines to Marine. And I think we will probably start out doing that at the Air Force Academy as long as we are a core. But once we become an independent space force or an independent space guard, then that's really where we are going to advance spacefaring as far and fast as we possibly can. Because imagine a four-year undergraduate degree with the intensity that they put into their aviation program at the Air Force Academy. It was novel when the cadets built a single satellite and launched down those first Falcon rockets. Remember that? Imagine if that was just commonplace. Imagine if you couldn't even graduate from the school unless you and your team had a satellite successfully in space. Imagine that.
Oh, yes, the quality of engineering. And that's my underlying thing is engineering is a separate discipline from speaking English.
You are right, sir. It absolutely is.
So this would be
I'm a software engineer. Believe me, I can write stuff that does wonders in totally obscure languages that you can't even explain in English.
So Coyote, this would be like the Coast Guard Academy or the Maritime Academy, but it would be the Space Academy.
Yes, that's right. In fact, we've already insisted that we get the Presidio back.
Well, that's in the heart of Space Cadet Land in San Francisco. So, hey, perfect.
It is, and it's also a fantastic location because of the Silicon Valley and the high-tech industries that are out there that do complement spacefaring so heavily.
Yeah, and the Federation got it right years and years ago. So
yeah.
keep that in mind for the Presidio. Marshall, what else on your agenda, please?
That is the key thing is the technology is going to be moving ahead so fast that unless we train people at least a good solid foundation in space technology, we're just slowing down everybody.
I'm a fan of yours, Marshall. That's great.
Okay. Marshall, thanks for your call.
Until next time.
Until next time. Last question for you from Joshua in Tucson. Where is NASA in all of this? Are they relevant or irrelevant or in the middle of the fence?
NASA, that organization has what a great history and the tremendous accomplishments that they've made. You know, I feel badly for NASA in many ways. A lot of people give them criticisms, but they have suffered underneath administrations that change their mind, that give them new directions, really have given them such turbulence that it's remarkable the achievements that they've made in the face of some tremendous bureaucracy of their own. As we create the Space Corps, we will sit there and look at our partner in NASA as this obvious partner opportunity. If we go the direction of a space force, and we follow the DOD, present DOD model, then NASA would remain NASA, and the Space Force would be something else. However, if we became a space guard, there is the potential that NASA would become part of the space guard, and that NASA would be the research brunt
of the advancement of Space Guard spacefaring. And as I've said, that would that our Space Guard is a flag follows trade kind of proposition. A Space Guard is absolutely serious-minded about the advancement of commercial spacefaring and doing whatever it can to advance it, but also to safeguard lives, protect property, and to ensure navigation and passage for all lawful and non-hostile users regardless of nationality. So it is entirely possible that after we make a Space Corps and we think about it, that we could create an organization that brings together the Space Guard and NASA into one body.
Interesting, a hybrid NASA.
Yeah.
Coyote, what should we have talked about or I've forgotten to ask you or we've overlooked or that you wanted to continue to say as we come to the close of today's program?
Oh, well, of course, David, we need to talk about space-based solar power.
Okay.
There is tremendous interest down here in Alabama to bring in companies that want to study and build space-based solar power systems. It's a right-to-work state, sits on 15% of the fresh water in the United States, wonderful interstate, good railroad, and plenty of airports. It's an opportunity for companies out there that want to examine looking at space-based solar power, want to examine doing space-based solar power, rather, to get their feet in and a place that wants to support them.
We yesterday on Open Lines, we talked about this recent Forbes article where they were suggesting that President Trump do some initial starting of space-based solar power. So do you see anything happening on this front other than rhetoric and desires? They didn't have a good reception during the Obama administration with the Office of Science and Technology. So where's it going to be, with this one? I'm kind of lukewarm on it, but honestly, I'd rather see the government put some R&D money into that than a lot of things the government puts money into, because I think that is an investment in our future, and it's also a wealth creator.
Yes.
So I would be supportive of that, but how does that get traction, and will Trump have people that are supportive of it?
You know, that's a very good question, and, that's high politics, and that depends on stuff that I don't have a lot of insight into. But what I can say is that there could be a grassroots swelling. You know, for example, if the state of Alabama is interested in pursuing this type of thing or in giving the type of economic incentives that they've given to other companies such as Hyundai Motors, there's a reason why the state of Alabama is the third largest producer of automobiles in the United States. And that has to do with the favorable business environment that they have here. They also have Huntsville, with the single largest concentration of aerospace scientists that do research and engineering and rocket science and space science probably in the world. I don't know. You might find something bigger in a foreign country, but I struggle to imagine it. I think where space-based solar power is today is that the business case simply is not made. But we are seeing tremendous advances in companies such as Northrop Grumman, which has been reducing the overall launch weight of massive Gossamer structures and also developing new high-efficiency solar arrays. Now, the good news about that is doing either of those things gives you a cash flow for the advancement of the science and technology that you're doing now. You know, if we have improved solar arrays, they're improved here on Earth, too, but they work better in space. And so it remains an engineering problem, and it remains an economic finance and business problem. But those cases are closing. I think NASA is on the verge of creating a task force to do another fresh look study at space-based solar power. It has been 10 years since the DOD-led study, and I think it's time to see how the numbers have improved.
Is Air Force thinking of doing an update to that famous study that you spearheaded with National Space Society?
You know, no, I don't think the Air Force is going to step forward with space-based solar power. The idea was never for the Air Force to do it, but rather to become a customer of that energy should it be available. There is a time when energy has a premium, and I'm thinking about convoying petroleum in combat zones. The experience that we had in Afghanistan and Iraq was horrendous. There were terrorist threats during different months of the war. There were terrorist threats everywhere. There were IEDs, improvised explosive devices, going off, destroying fuel convoys. It was just terrible. And if we had something like space-based solar power to simply broadcast safe, clean electrical energy to the users and put into the electrical power grid that way, it would have alleviated a tremendous burden from us.
Wouldn't more effective rules of engagement eliminated a lot of burdens for you, too?
Well, if you can get rid of your enemy quickly, that always helps.
We'll leave that one there. Any timeline for goosing Congress or writing letters? Early in the show you said, you know, the big chance for action is within the first year of a new administration. So we're 9.5 months, you know, or 8.5 months into the new administration. So do we have a timeline to December to act, or is there an urgency? I guess that's
my
question.
Well, here's some insider information for you.
Okay.
On the 4th of April, one of your sponsors, the 33rd Space Symposium, is going to be hosting Congressman Mike Rogers from Alabama's District 3. He's the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee Strategic Oversight. And he is going to be speaking, and he's going to be laying out the case for reorganization of national security space.
Are you going to be there?
I will not.
Oh, too bad.
Oh, I know. I would love to be there. Because I imagine that there would be a cocktail party afterwards that I would like to attend.
Well, I would, too. Hopefully I can finagle an invitation to it.
So, but David, you're probably going to have a front row seat, since this is going to be the first year you're going to attend that event. You'd ought to go to hear Congressman Rogers give that presentation.
I absolutely will do so, and I will try to get up and introduce myself and mention you and mention this program and our focus on it. And who knows, maybe I could get someone from his office to come on and talk about logistics and what it really takes to make this happen congressionally.
Yeah.
If he or his staffers would have the time and be willing to do that.
Yeah.
But I will be there, and I will be sure to attend that program. I get in Sunday evening, so I'm looking forward to that.
David, I've taken a look at your website, and my gosh, the changes you've made since that first website that you hung out there years ago.
Yeah, we did a Indiegogo plan a couple of years ago and rebuilt the website, so it has a whole different search engine and all sorts of other stuff, and we're experimenting with Google Ads to generate some more revenue. We'll see how that works after a month. You know, hopefully we can continue to make additional changes. Also, guest pictures are on there, so your picture is on there for your bio. And, you know, it should work out a little bit better. The blog is right there. You don't have to go to a separate WordPress page to get to our blog, so that makes it a lot more convenient. But the battles are still uphill, whether you have a good website or not.
Oh, of course.
So we're 16 years old in May. And
wow, David, it's been that long.
Yeah, and we're just a tad short now of 3,000 shows.
Wow. Hey, congratulations. What a service you've provided. You've built a community and kept us all plugged in.
Well, I hope, and hopefully we can continue to talk to you about this issue and keep it on the minds of listeners and people that hear it. And we do have a lot of foreign listeners, Coyote, so in concluding here, people from all over the country and all over the world. So I've got people in Mexico and Canada, all throughout Europe. But also when I look at the ISP numbers, we got about 400 people in China that listen to the show and people in Iran that listen to the show. What do you say to people that listen to the Space Show and will hear your program and they're not necessarily from an ally or a friendly U.S. country?
Yeah, work with us. Help us get this right. I know that as a serving member in the Air Force for 30 years and now continuing to provide education here at Air University, we're very open to actually hearing all of the ideas of how to make these things, these organizations work to advance. It still sits in our space policies and strategies, the international cooperation is part of our goal, using space as a venue for international cooperation to improve our our community ship here on Earth has always been one of the standards that NASA and the Air Force and our National Reconnaissance Office have been looking for. I really think that the establishment of a Space Corps will allow the international community that's interested in space to speak for the first time to an organization that has no other distractions other than advancing human spacefaring.
And just even though this is sort of emanating out of the Air Force, this is not about military conquest. And,
no.
And you can assure our foreign listeners of that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. This establishment of a Space Corps is to ensure that we protect life, that we protect property, that we ensure freedom of navigation, freedom of passage for all lawful and non-hostile users, regardless of their nationality. That is the clarion call that drives us.
And, Coyote, I will let you know if I can deal with Mike Rogers. I'll look for him at the Space Symposium, and I hope to talk to you again down the road soon, and as soon as I can archive our program, I'll send it to you, and you can reference it as you feel appropriate.
Fantastic. Thank you, David.
Thank you, and listeners, to all of you who called in and sent in emails, thank you very much for participating. It's the first of the week, so everybody have a terrific week coming up, and keep it safe, and keep looking up. Goodbye from Coyote Smith, myself, and The Space Show.